Good evening to everybody tonight. Go ahead and have your Bible open to John 20. Thanks to JJ for leading Thomas's song for us. I asked him if he would do that, and notice that I could never lead a song if my life depended on it, but I can ask guys to lead hard ones. And that was a song that I wanted us to think of the words about because of the little project we've been involved in on Sunday nights. We've been trying to think, what did Jesus teach between the time when he was raised up from the grave and when he ascended to the right hand of his Father? And we've been trying to point out that each time Jesus appeared to individuals or to groups, he taught something. If not by what he said, which in most cases is true, but also by what he did. And I want you to kind of reemphasize in your mind what Jesus is doing in this period of time is preparing for the establishment and the growth of his kingdom in this world. And that means that in each of these cases, there will be principles found that if you think about them, will be vitally important in working with people and in our not only in our own individual faith, but also in the leadership and the instruction and the edification of the church that we're part of, and that makes it important. Now tonight, here we are about the sixth one of these cases, and it's 1 week later from where we were last Sunday evening. John counts by Roman times, and last time he was speaking to us about the Sunday evening. The Lord had been raised up in that morning, and remember there was the appearance to the ten who were gathered together. And you might remember the conversation, and then what was said when they went and told their friend Thomas, "You should have been there. You never believe what happened." And sure enough, he didn't. And that brings us to the place where we are in our study tonight. I hope you'll think about this. Barry's going to read the passage for us, John chapter 20, verses 26 through 29.
A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands? Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed."
Thank you, Barry. Now, you think about the situation that's here in this passage. I have read it and studied it before from the perspective of Thomas. I can identify with Thomas. I don't think of him as the doubter. I think of him as a realist and a pessimist. And I can sympathize with him. He has made a commitment that he never thought would happen, and now he's going to be held to it. He said, "I'll never believe unless I see the scars in his hands and his side." And I don't imagine he thought he would have to, but now have you ever already committed yourself to something, and then it comes to pass, and now there you are. What are you going to do about it? And that's the situation here. I don't think I've ever thought to study this passage from Jesus' perspective. That's kind of strange if when I think about it. The Lord is appearing to his disciples, and I've never thought about how this might have looked from what does this tell me about him? And so in keeping with what we've been doing, I want to suggest to you the principles that are in this passage that you and I should pay attention to as well. What did Jesus teach here that might still help us? Number one, in this event, which happens that Barry's just read to us about, Jesus demonstrates for once and for all of us, his willingness to minister to doubt. And what I mean by that is the Lord showed that he is willing to come to the aid of the honest struggler. And I think this is a lesson. When I read the story of Thomas, I think to myself about the difference between disbelief and unbelief. Disbelief is a situation where you're having trouble grasping a fact or a truth about something. Unbelief is where you're not willing to. And where you're in a situation, you are ignoring the evidence and so forth. In the case of Thomas here, you notice in verse 26, it said that 8 days later, a week later, the disciples are inside again, and now Thomas is with them. And the Lord, although the doors are locked, Jesus came and he stood among them. Notice this is an important detail, and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "How do you like to be singled out in a crowd?" You're in a room with a group of people, and the door is closed, and the Lord stands there, the risen Lord stands there, and he says, "Thomas." I have a feeling at that moment it was pretty clear who he had come to see, if I can say it that way. It was Thomas. And Thomas is the fellow, if you remember, Jesus speaks to him, "Put your finger here," and so forth. That would say to me that he has come because of what Thomas said before, not only to see Thomas, but to deal with something that Thomas has said in the previous occasion. You know, the picture of Thomas that we get in the Gospel of John is pretty akin to the modern mind, if you think about it. Thomas is a fella who, when we meet him first off in John chapter 11, when he really speaks, it's the time when Jesus has gone beyond the Jordan, but then he's gotten word that his friend Lazarus is sick back in Bethany, and the Lord waits, and then he tells his disciples that their friend Lazarus has died, and they're going to go back, and so forth. And Thomas is the one who speaks up. They've tried to reason with Jesus about the danger, and Thomas is the one who speaks up and said, "Let's go with him, that we may die with him." He's a man of courage, but he's also a man who has the streak of pessimism or reality, I guess, in his mind. He's still willing to go there, though, and we shouldn't overlook that. When we get over in John chapter 14, and Jesus is talking about going to prepare a place for him, and him being the way and so forth, Thomas says, "We don't know where you're going. We don't know how to get there. So how are we supposed to come?" And that's my very loose paraphrase, of course. And Jesus deals with Thomas with the great claim, "I'm the way, the truth, and the life." You remember? And then he went ahead to tell him, "If you've seen the Father, you've seen me." In verse 9 of that chapter, in John chapter 14. So you get a picture of Thomas. He is a fellow who needs answers. He wants to do the right thing, but he keeps seeing the reality in front of him. Now, in this case, if you guys will remember, we read last week from Mark 16 at verse 14 that when Jesus appeared to the ten, he rebuked them because they had not believed the word that had been brought to him that he had risen. He corrected them for their not believing the evidence or the testimony of eyewitnesses. In this case, Thomas, if anything, has been even more hesitant to believe. But look at Jesus making a point to appear here in order to deal with Thomas's Now, do you think he did it just for Thomas, or did he do it partly for me and partly for you? Doesn't it help us to know that Jesus teaches that those of us who struggle with the idea of a resurrection from the dead, and those of us who have a hard time taking something on the testimony of someone else, and those of us who hesitate to believe what we haven't already figured out every detail of and so forth, we're blessed by this appearance to Thomas. And I think that's one of the things the Lord meant to. Secondly, in this passage, in this event, the Lord demonstrates once and for all again his awareness of what goes on within us. The Lord demonstrates his familiarity with what we human beings say and do. This is an important idea in many places in the New Testament. You notice it here, though. Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe." Well, that was quite a challenge. Would you have had the nerve to do it if you'd been there? Would you have actually reached out your hand and touched? Thomas didn't end up having to do that. He's convinced. But you see the point. The thing is, though, Jesus quotes what Thomas said a week earlier when the ten told Thomas about Jesus' appearance to them. Notice the closeness of the statement from verse 25. Thomas had said, "Unless I see his hands, the mark of his nails, and place my nails and place my finger into the mark of the nails, place my hands into his side, I will never believe." Can you see that Jesus has quoted Thomas to Thomas? And he's done it without having been there when Thomas made that statement before. He knew what Thomas' mind was, what Thomas' heart was. There are times when I need to know that and you need to know that. The times when we feel like nobody understands. The times when we feel like we can play the hypocrite and get away with it. The times when we feel like that we have tried to help or tried to serve or anything else and nobody has paid any attention at all. We need to know the Lord knows hearts. Please be aware of this theme from the New Testament. In John 2, this same gospel, at verses 24 and 25, John said, "But Jesus on his part did not entrust himself to them because he knew all people and needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew what was in man." That's a statement of the doctrine that I'm getting at here. In Hebrews 4, at verse 13, this is right after the great verse on the power of the Lord's Word. It's important for us to realize the power of the Lord's Word is reinforced by the reality of the Lord's knowledge. In verse 13, it said, "And no creature is hidden from his sight, but all are naked and exposed to the eyes of him to whom we must give account." I'm told that the two words that are in this version translated naked and exposed are especially vivid. One of them had to do, it is said, with what would be done if there were a criminal who was about to meet his sentence or about to be sentenced to his judgment. And if that criminal did not want for his face to appear on the evening news and so forth, they would hold the point of a knife right under his chin, so that his face would be open to everybody who would look on. And the other word is the term that would be used if you were skinning an animal, if you were flaying the skin and laying the carcass open to full view. That's a pretty vivid way of telling us that the Lord knows what goes on in our hearts and our minds. One great illustration of this, even for the whole church, happens in the early chapters of Revelation. In Revelation 1 and verse 14, when we see the vision of one likened to the Son of Man, the glorified Christ, he has eyes like torches, eyes like blazing fire, to represent the fact that he sees and knows the hearts of his people, what his people go through. And then in each one of the seven letters, the Lord will say, after he's introduced, "I know your works. I know what you're going through. I know what you're doing. I know what's being done to you. I know." And that happens each time. And that's a part of the conviction we need about our Christ. So in this event, the Lord demonstrates his awareness, his knowledge of us. He knows about us. That idea is here. Then in the third place, in this event, Jesus demonstrates his claim to, or his willingness to accept, to be addressed as deity. He accepts in this passage, without correcting the speaker, a declaration that could only have been made to somebody who was actually by nature God. This is an important, and again, a very meaningful thing if you get to thinking about it. Thomas, confronted by the Lord's, "Do not disbelieve, but believe," Thomas just answers him, "My Lord and my God." Lord means master, owner, and ruler. This term would have been the way the name of God would have been translated into Greek, and then God is he's recognized him as the one worthy of worship and of devotion and service, and so on. And Jesus allows this statement. He doesn't correct Thomas. He acts as if it's a statement that should have been made by Thomas, even without having to have him appear to cause it to be made. Now, this is a statement and a reaction that ought to be contrasted with the other cases where these kinds of things are said in the New Testament to people who are not God and who are not Lord. It's really stunning when you think about this. In Acts chapter 10, Peter makes his arrival in Caesarea at the household of Cornelius. Cornelius has sent for him, has been waiting for him. He knows he's going to hear how to be saved from him. So when Peter enters his house, verse 25 of Acts 10, Cornelius met him and fell down at his feet and worshiped him. Peter was an apostle. He had a message of life. He was somebody who had recently had a part in raising a man from the dead himself, or a woman from the dead himself. But look at this. Peter lifted him up, saying, "Stand up. I too am a man." Why didn't Jesus do that with Thomas? Then look over in Acts chapter 14 when Barnabas and Paul are at Lystra. They've made a crippled man well just through the name of Christ. And the people saw what had happened and they started crying out in their native language, "The gods have come down in the likeness of men." They called Barnabas Zeus and Paul Hermes, or Jupiter and Mercury, if you will. And then the priest of Zeus, whose temple was at the entrance of the city, brought oxen and garlands to the gate and wanted to offer sacrifice with the crowds. But when the apostles, in this case Barnabas is included in that phrase, and Paul heard of it, they tore their garments. Look how seriously they took this. And this is Acts 14, verse 14. They tore their garments and rushed out into the crowd, crying out, "Men, why are you doing these things? We're also men of like nature with you, and we bring you good news that you should turn from these vain things to a living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that's in them." And they just barely were able to keep the people from making the mistake of treating them like gods. But notice the strong insistence that that wasn't appropriate. Well, think about the angels even over in Revelation. Revelation 19 now, verses 9 and 10. John said, "The angel said to me, 'Write this, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb.' And he said to me, 'These are the true words of God.'" And John says, this is an apostle now, like Thomas, "Then I fell down at his feet to worship him. But he said to me, 'You must not do that. I'm a fellow servant with you and your brothers who hold to the testimony of Jesus. Worship God.'" I'd say that was a pretty firm, a pretty strong correction, wouldn't you? Look over in chapter 22, verse 8 and 9. Chapter 22 of Revelation, now verses 8 and 9. "I, John, am the one who heard and saw these things, and when I heard and saw them, I fell down to worship at the feet of the angel who showed them to me. But he said to me, 'You must not do that. I'm a fellow servant with you and your brothers, the prophets, and with those who keep the words of this book. Worship God.'" I can see that neither the apostles nor the angels allowed themselves to be reverenced as if they were God. I sure shouldn't. Nor should anybody else on this earth today expect that kind of treatment or allow it. But look at Jesus. Thomas speaks out, "Is my Lord and my God." And Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you've seen me?" Look, he's not correcting him, is he? He's accepting it as the truth. I think that reassures me of what I meant when I said, I believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And it reminds me that my confession was a good confession, and it was the truth. And if I can stay with it, I'm going to be way, way better off because of it. Now, it brings us to the fourth principle. In this event, notice also, Jesus teaches, Jesus demonstrates the real nature of belief. And it is that reliance upon that which is unseen, and then Jesus blesses belief. And when I use the word reliance, I mean acceptance of something as fact, and I mean obedience to whatever might be involved, and I mean trust in that which is believed. So in this event, Jesus shows that belief is going to involve the acceptance of what you can't see right now. Look again at verse 29. Jesus said to Thomas, "Have you believed because you have seen me?" I wonder just how that question ought to be taken. Is Jesus saying that Thomas had believed, or is he saying that Thomas had to be convinced? I kind of think the latter. I think he's pointing out, Thomas, you weren't able to accept reality without having to have a miracle to prove it to you, this appearance here. But Jesus said, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." How could those who've not seen believe? Well, remember last week we studied the power of a message borne by qualified witnesses. He's saying, Thomas, you have believed just because or only because I appeared to you and you demanded to see. But there are going to be people, Thomas, who believe because of the message that you're going to carry to some of them about things they can't see. That's that idea, of course. I'm talking about the gospel and Thomas's part in bearing the gospel to other people, whatever his part might have been. I know he was there in Acts 2 and had a part in what took place there that day. The meaning or the significance of this to the nature of faith is powerful. Paul, in speaking of faith in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 7, says we walk by faith, not by sight. And that's always going to be the situation with the Lord's people. However much we have individuals who want to talk to us about evidences, I'm glad there are people who are qualified to do that and can do it. We're still going to have to walk by faith. There'll never be a situation where someone can prove something so powerfully that it will convince someone who does not want to believe that Jesus is the Son of God and that there's life in Him. In John 17, in the great prayer that's prayed, verse 11, Jesus said, "And I'm no longer in the world, but they're in the world, and I'm coming to you." And then at verse 15 he said, "I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one." They're going to be in a situation where they're going to have to rely on what they can't see, and the Lord is praying for them in that way. In Hebrews 11, this theme is a wonderful part of the statement of Hebrews 11. Look at verse 1, verse 7, verse 13, and so on. In each case, it emphasizes the faithful action people took, even though they were acting in the interest of things they could not see at that moment. How important that is. In 1 Peter chapter 1, at verses 8 and 9, Peter writes to people who are in the fiery trial, "Though you have not seen him, you love him. Though you do not now see him, you believe in him and rejoice with the joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory, obtaining the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your souls." What did Jesus teach in his talk with Thomas? That he wants to help honest strugglers. That he knows what goes on in our hearts and our thoughts and our lives, that he is still worthy of our confession and our trust, but that it will require reliance upon what we cannot see all along the way. Please think about this little episode this week and learn, be helped by it. John 20 ends with, "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in His name." So do you? And have you said so? And have you been baptized into Christ for the forgiveness of your sins? And are you walking in the light as a believer? Or is there something we need to pray about? If there is, in either case, please indicate if you need to make that act of faith in Christ real tonight. And if we can help you, come while we stand and sing this song together.